live from the NBC News Radio broadcasting studios of KCAA 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM, located in beautiful California. Thanks for tuning into the Water Zone. I'm Rob Starr, along with Mr. Chris Davey.
Good afternoon, sir. How
I was going to introduce you. You can jump right in.
We're doing fine here. Great.
That's called the sidekick.
Yes.
You kick me to...
Yes, I'm your Baba Louie.
I like that. So if I hit the top of your head, are you going to bounce up and down?
I'll do the thinning around here.
Well, we had a good week. These weeks are just zipping by, I'm telling you.
Yeah, time flies when you're having fun. Unless you're a trout, then time's fun when you're having flies.
That's a good one. We should talk to Bass Pro Shops and see if they'll come aboard doing stuff. Well, we have a good show today. I know you and I had a great time last Friday.
We did.
And we were at down by Disneyland, actually, and we went to the Grand California Hotel, and we were participating in what was called Water, What's Behind the Magic, and that was put on by the Metropolitan Water District of Orange County, and it was really a good event. We had a super opportunity of interviewing a bunch of people, which I'm very surprised at, and very pleased and honored that we had the opportunity to interview some of these people, which we're going to be playing over the next couple of weeks.
The interviews with those people. Yep, yes. Absolutely.
One of my favorites, who really isn't in, well, I shouldn't say he's not in the water business because he's a weather person, and that was Fritz Coleman. And to have him, a fellow NBC affiliate kind of guy, and I mean, he was unbelievably humble and totally different than I would have expected him to be. Not that I thought he was a snob or above anybody, just a really nice person, and gave some nice words to us, and I appreciate that. And, so I'm happy he did that.
And had a real concern, a real interest in water issues, not in California, but in the West particularly. And that came through, I think, in the way he presented himself and the comments he made as master of ceremonies for the water summit.
Yeah, he was very prepared. I mean, he knew what was going on.
Yeah, certainly let his chops show in terms of his interest and knowledge about water issues in the West.
Absolutely.
It was a great morning, actually. You know, I mean, looking at all the things that the California drought has brought, and then and the subsequent rains and you know, swing of the pendulum that we had this particular winter and the winter before. And it was just a good four-hour look, a close and deliberate look at what it takes to bring a finite water source, right, to the communities here. The focus on collection, storage, conveyance, treatment, you name it. Desal, it was all in the agenda.
Did you just create that? right off the top of your head. That's good. You did well. No, that's absolutely true. I was very amazed at how in-depth he was. And also what intrigued me is all the things behind the scenes that he does and how he prepares and do that. Well, we want to bring on one of our favorite persons. And I want to do a little bit more in the introduction for this person, because she contributes a lot. And this is a leading voice in California water news, Ms. Chris Austin. She's the founder and publisher of the independent and reader-supported Maven's Notebook website. She's dedicated to providing information about California water issues. The water news source reaches thousands of regular readers and water leaders throughout the state. She's based in Southern California, but regularly she travels throughout the state to cover conferences, meetings, events, even comes to the studio here. She's earned a stellar reputation, and stellar isn't good enough. It's higher than stellar among the state's agriculture, environmental, and water stakeholders for complete, timely, and accurate reporting and news curation. She's great. She's been doing this for over a decade, and she's recognized in 2016 by online news agency Environment and Energy Publishing as one of 9 Californians who play key role in water policy. So maybe she can run for office. I hope so. I'll vote for her. Anyway, welcome to the show, the purveyor of Maven's Notebook, Chris Austin.
Oh, hi. How you doing, guys?
We're good. All right, Chris. We're doing great. Thank you.
I want to run for office.
Well, you can walk. I wanted to give you a more of a professional introduction, because you bring a lot to our show, and we appreciate that.
Yeah, should.
Thank you.
We should also note, Chris, that as part of the Water Summit, the OC Water Summit, you were a moderator for one of the sessions over there, particularly the water bond. And so maybe we can start off by giving a little introduction about how you felt about the day.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was really a really great program. And it was, you know, Fritz is a great MC, and I have a little bit of an affinity with Fritz because my dad was a TV meteorologist. He was a meteorologist, though, in Reno, Nevada. And we're talking, you know, 30 years ago when we didn't have all the radar and whiz bang stuff we had. And you know, with the mountain range in between the coastal storms and Reno, weather didn't always pan out.
Right.
You know, but down here, when the forecast is wrong, you know, Fritz and all these weather guys, they have, it's a cutoff low.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't expect it to rain. It's a cutoff low. My dad had none of that. He was just wrong.
didn't have the Doppler 7 and all that stuff to.
No. And sometimes those mountains do unpredictable things. But sometimes so does the cutoff lows. So I thought that was. Anyways, he's very funny, and you're right. He's really a very smart guy. I thought it was a really interesting day. Nice program, nice production. It was great to moderate a panel there. We talked about water bonds.
Mm-hmm.
We had Jerry Merrill there. Talked briefly about Prop 68. I don't think Prop 68 had a lot of support in Orange County. If, you know, the Taxpayers Association wasn't for it, and neither was the OC Register. And I think even the San Diego Union Tribune said no, but it passed anyways.
Yeah.
It seemed like that was going to happen because there really wasn't any opposition to that. So that passed. And so Jerry Merrill's water bond was the main focus of the panel. And his bond comes up in November.
Mm.
And it's going to be a lot easier to get money for water storage projects from his bond than the current bond that the Prop 1 funds that the Water Commission is trying to spend.
Yep. Well, what was interesting, the first speaker, Robert Hartman, who's the hydrologist and consultant, and he was talking about forecasting future water supplies. I know he had mentioned that he didn't think it was, at least it was his opinion, that it wasn't the right thing to do to think about building another dam or building more dams because it would take too long and it cost too much money. And I kind of stopped and paused at that in my head, thinking, wow, why wouldn't we do that? Why wouldn't we be thinking that far down the road? I mean, yes, it takes forever to, like the desal plant that took 17 years in Carlsbad. I mean, why? First of all, why can't the planning and all the process you got to go through, why does it take that long to do? And don't we need more water storage places? I mean, I would think we would.
Well, yes, I think water storage is important, but one of the big things that we're kind of up against is that all of the good spots for dams are pretty much taken in the state.
They can't build them next to each other?
It's the topography. Mm. You know, you need a canyon of some sort and, you know, in a dam, and we've dammed most of it. Now, Scythe Reservoir up in Colusa County is kind of like Diamond Bar.
Mm-hmm.
Not Diamond Bar, Diamond Valley,
right.
Lake out there. So they've kind of got enough hills so that they're going to build, I think, three dams, you know, to contain the water there. It's upstream, and I think that's a pretty worthwhile project. Los Vaqueros Reservoir is one that they want to raise the dam, and that's in a good spot. Temperance Flat is the one that's kind of iffy. That would be putting in a dam above Bryant Dam on the San Joaquin River. The problem with that one, and the problem with building dams in places where the topography doesn't really fit it, is it makes it very expensive.
Well,
and it's expensive water.
How about if you do it out in the desert and you put a piping system in from one dam to that? Yes, it's going to cost money, but now you got another big place to store. I mean, there's plenty.
Well, if the topography works, I mean, you can't build a mountain necessarily. You know, you kind of have to have it. And one of the things also to keep in mind, or to, you know, the flip side of this is that there is a lot more storage in groundwater. And we have a lot of empty aquifers, or, you know, aquifers at the levels down that they can take a lot of storage.
Right.
They could take water in if we can find ways to get it sunk into these aquifers.
Yeah.
And really, there's so much more groundwater storage than all the surface storage we could ever, that we have now, we could ever build. I mean, it's massive. And groundwater, I think really, when we're talking about, you know, climate change and deep drought, groundwater is really where it's at.
Right.
But we still need surface storage, yes. You know, and we, and I think there are some good projects out there, and we should continue to explore those. But we should also be paying attention to groundwater storage.
Yeah, well, especially in Southern California.
Yeah.
So
you know, where we can. Although I have to say, we're very good down here. We have a lot of things going on. There's not a lot of, you know, I don't think there's a lot, there's much that we're missing down here, I guess I should say.
Oh.
All the water agencies are very active.
Southern California, you mean, Chris, yeah.
In Southern California,
right.
Yes.
Okay. What did you think? Now, we had Senator Moniger on.
Yeah, this is the water tax that not popular down here.
No, it was not. what did you think about that?
Well, you know, I officially can't take a position on things, but I can say, I hope I can say, I'm for people having clean water.
Yes, we all agree to that.
And yes. And it looks like this water tax is headed for a vote in the legislature. So, I get why they object to the water tax and everything. I do get that. But the problem is when you have to rely on appropriations from the general fund to fund a program that needs to go on for a long period of time, you're subject to the whims of the legislature.
Right.
And, you know, we have this no term limits, forever freshmen and sophomore legislators moving around there, and, you know, preferences change, things change. And that's kind of the problem. We really need to solve this problem, and it takes money, and it takes a kind of a continuous dream of money in order to get this done.
Yeah,
and it looks like the legislature is getting ready to do that.
Yeah, it's not a one and done, is it, Chris?
No, it's not. And it's, you know, this, I think they make some great points, you know, this looks like the plan that is going to, you know, well, it's going to the vote at the legislature, and we'll see what happens there.
Well, one of the questions, I would have liked to get up and ask the question, because they had the microphones for an open mic, but the gentleman wasn't there. It was a videotape, so we couldn't, and I was surprised that he didn't send a representative to do that. I don't know if that was on purpose or not, but be that as it may, the question I would have asked is, and I agree with your earlier statement, we all believe from our hearts and everything else that everybody should be able to have fresh drinking water, especially here in the United States and especially here in California. All agree to that. What I don't understand, aren't there regulations that say what the level of cleanliness the water or purity the water has to be to any water agency? And if that's true, which I believe it is, then why is the appropriate associations or agencies letting this happen? Why don't they just shut them down?
Good question.
Well, the problem is that the people can't pay the bills. That they have gone out and they have installed a well in some of these, you know, one of these small towns, I can't remember which one, to clean out the nitrate, but they're the economic base in this town, which is primarily poor farm workers, they can't afford to run it.
No, you're right.
But people still need some water piped to their home. So, you know, they go on piping water. But it's worse if you just shut it down, then people have absolutely nothing, then, you know, your house can be condemned.
No,
I don't have running water.
I agree with that 1,000%. What I want to see is if a small agency that can't make any money by doing the right thing can't make it happen because they have ratepayers who don't pay or can't pay or whatever. Then, and like I said, I believe in people should be able to get clean water to drink for their kids, for their family, everything.
Yeah, yeah.
There's no reason that they can't shut them down, because if there's no way for them to make money, they shouldn't be operating, period. Shut it down, give it to see if a bigger agency will take it over and do what they got to do for that. But
And that's one of the things that they're working on doing is consolidating some of these smaller systems. Because in a lot of cases, or at least in some of these cases, these smaller systems sit on the outskirts of other towns. And there's a legacy involved here, a kind of a sad legacy, that a lot of these towns are filled with immigrants and people of color. And, you know, in the years, you know, in the early 20th century, those people were excluded. It's sort of the sad part before the civil rights era.
Yeah.
And still to this day, they live with this legacy. And so the state board, in some cases, has actually ordered some of these water systems to hook up these other neighborhoods. And that people don't, you know, some people don't like that, but that's one of the things that they're working on doing. They're just saying, you know, you just got to fix this. You got to do this.
Yeah. I think, Chris, one of the deeper issues, if you dig into this a little bit more, right, I don't think there's anybody out there disagrees that access to clean drinking water is, you know, it's a critical issue, right? Public health, it's a social issue as well. And I know that many of the public water agencies, they understand the depth and the meaning of the issue. But something like SB 623, right? I mean, it essentially takes water agencies and puts them in the tax collecting business, right? I mean, close to that.
Yeah.
And they don't want that. You know, I don't think it's fair to characterize the water agencies as sort of cruel, heartless, don't care. I mean, they want to find another way to pay for this. I'm just, you know, I'm not sure how viable the other, you know, what they're proposing exactly, which is general fund appropriations. I don't think that really, I mean, that's not a great way to finance something that needs to be financed long term.
No, I just believe from what I read that the state of California has an abundance of money that they don't want to touch, or they're putting it to projects that aren't near the top of what's critical to human life, and I think that's more important. Again, I'm trying not to be as political, but, you know, I'd rather see them fix the drinking water for the people who can't afford or any of that versus a train that's not going anywhere. I mean, that's just my personal thing, and I'm always going to say that. But, you know, from what I've read, California's got money to do these things, and you know, when they're playing with human lives and children and things like that, I mean, I just don't understand it. That should be a number one priority, at least in my mind and my heart. That's what I believe.
And so, I also think that one thing that the water agencies are saying is likely to come true. And they say, you know, we start with this, and there's going to be other things that are going to start getting tacked on your water bill.
Right.
And this is something that actually, it's actually kind of true. We get all the water from Northern California, but we, the people of Southern California, are not really paying for those impacts, for the restoration that needs to be done. Those funds are trying to come from the general fund, so the whole state pays. But the truth is, the Northern people say, I say not the truth, but the Northern people say, you know, you get the water, we get the impact, and there's a bit of truth to that.
Right.
And I think at some point we need to expect that we're going to pay more, because there is impact to the places that we draw the water from, and we're not paying for those.
Right.
And so I do think they say, you know, this is going to open the door, and I think that's probably correct. That's probably what's going to happen. Again, I'm not sure that it's necessarily the wrong thing. We should be paying for the impacts of the water we receive, but that's never been built into our water bill.
Right. See, that's why you should run for office.
Oh, yeah. This is really popular. This will get me elected. Your water bill is going to cost you more. I mean, my parents live in Reno, and the water comes from the Truckee River, which flows through town, and groundwater, which they pump right there. There's no imports into Reno. They live with what comes to them. And water bills there are $100-$150 a month. Our water bill is around $50. Uh-huh. And my water comes from Northern California and gets flung over the Tehachapi.
Yeah.
And it's $50 to me. It's, you know, three times that for the people up in Reno.
Yeah.
We're not paying the true cost of our water, unfortunately, here in Southern California.
No, you're right. What other takeaways did you get from the event on last Friday?
I thought Brenda Berman's speech was interesting.
And for our audience, you want to tell them who Brenda is?
She is the commissioner of the Bureau of Reclamation.
Right.
And she really pushed for Shasta Dam, pointing out that when they wanted to raise Shasta Dam in the 80s, they were thinking like raising it 200 feet, and this is just 18 and a half feet. But she spoke very positively of that project. We'll see what happens, because the state is on the record as, I believe that they've actually passed legislation that says that they will not participate in anything having to do with raising Shasta Dam. And the feds need a local funding partner in order to do that. So we'll see what happens. But I thought she was interesting. I thought Kurt Schwabe's presentation, which was on, he is from the University of California, Riverside, and he was talking about the impacts of drought on in recycled water. Mm-hmm. Like, we tend to say recycled water is a drought-proof water supply, but he has some data that shows it. Well, it's not out as drought-proof as you might think.
Right.
And that, you know, when people are using less water, what shows up at the water reclamation plants is much more concentrated and much, you know, saltier and harder to clean.
Right.
So I thought that was very interesting. I'm going to be covering his presentation on my blog. I covered Brenda Berman's today.
So okay. And Brenda, we were informed today that Brenda wants to be on our show.
Oh, great!
So we're excited about that. I'm going to coordinate that. I'm going to talk to her people next week, and we'll get a date from her. But she had to leave the event to get back to Washington, but she left a message for us that she certainly wants to be on the show. So that we're excited about that too. So,
well, that's great.
So we had a blast and everything else. Well, I'm going to let you go. We're up against our break, and we do appreciate you as always. And anybody that wants to be smarter in water, you go to mavensnotebook.com, and you can find out how to subscribe and sponsor and everything else. But you'll be smarter than us if you read her blog.
All right.
Have a great week, Chris.
You too, guys. Talk to you next week.
Okay. We'll be back in a second, so stick around for the second half of The Water Zone.
If you knew there was a pipe cement that works better than the one you're currently using, is better for you and the environment, and costs the same or less, would you buy it? No-brainer, right? Welldog, the trusted leader in solvent cements for over 60 years, is pleased to introduce a new line of solvent cements that does all that. Introducing the ECO Series line of solvent cements for PVC piping systems. Not only does it work great and set fast, it also has 30% lower solvent emissions and less smelly fumes. A better workplace environment when you're installing pipes. But don't just take our word for it. ECO Series products are the only solvent cements that are Green Seal certified for environmental innovation, for effective performance, improved working conditions, and for use with potable water. Now available in a medium-bodied, fast-setting blue formula, 905 ECO, and a regular-bodied, fast-setting clear formula, 900 ECO. Pick up a can today from your local distributor and see, smell, and feel the difference, just like Joe Sweat, president of Sunrise Irrigation, did. He said, after using Weldon's 905 ECO, we immediately noticed the application was smooth and there was noticeably less odor than other blue solvent cements on the market. The guys love it. To learn more about ECO solvent cements from Weldon, visit the website at www.weldon.com or call the technical service hotline at 877-477-8327. That's 877-477-8327.
Let's talk drought stress. No one likes burnt plants or grass, especially your customers. So when it's hotter than a tin roof in Tallahassee, what are you gonna do? Water the problem away? Not only does that abuse a vital resource, it's illegal in many cities. Here's a quick and easy solve that won't get you in trouble with Mother Nature or Johnny Law. Plied is a year-round program. Moisture Manager from LESCO supplements regular irrigation by attracting moisture to treated areas, thus making the moisture available to plant roots. This maintains wettability between waterings and rainfall, allowing soil to accept water as it becomes available, and making the water more accessible to the plant roots. Boom! More green, less watering, and a great new reason to see your customers on a recurring basis. With LESCO Moisture Manager and Site One, high heat is no sweat.
Well, welcome back to the second half of the Water Zone with Rob and Chris, and we're having a good day. That was great with Chris Austin. She's always good, and you know we're blessed to have smart people on our show. I got to tell you that, don't you think?
Absolutely, yeah. And the next one is certainly ranks in that group.
Oh, he's even higher than we are. he really is. And I'm not joking about him. He's a super nice guy I talked to on the phone. And his name is Nick Christians, and he's a professor at Iowa State University. He is the professor of horticulture at Iowa State in Ames, Iowa. And 54% of his work is teaching and 46% of his research. And when I was looking at and how I found him, or I discovered who he was a couple months ago, I happened to be reading a book that he helped co-wrote for Scott's Miracle-Gro Company on irrigation and things of that sort. And then I went and looked up his resume, and it's like 47 pages of all these documents and all these beautiful things that he's
published.
Written. Unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah.
Guy is second to none to me now. So I want to say hi, Nick. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Robert. You can hear me okay?
Absolutely. We're very blessed that you're on the show today, and thanks for coming on. We do appreciate it.
Absolutely. Yeah, Nick, welcome.
So, you know, like I said, I read a couple things that you've written, aside from that one book from Scott's. And Scott's used to be a sponsor to us. That's how I got the book and things. But how did you get interested? I always want to know, how did you get interested in selecting your career path? What drove you to doing that? Because I know you've done several things, like your golf course supervisor.
Well, I actually was going to be a wildlife biologist, a forest ranger. And I was going to Colorado State University. This is back in the late 60s and early 70s. That was the area I was studying through my undergraduate degree, but I had a friend that started a sod farm, so I started working with him and got interested in turf through that, and then I'd taken horticulture courses along with my forestry courses and that sort of thing. And when I graduated, I found that the jobs were very sparse in the area that I'd been trained in, but in the turf industry, there were a lot of opportunities. So I got a job as a golf course superintendent at Flatirons Country Club in Boulder, Colorado. Later became a superintendent at a club in Southern Colorado at Pueblo West. And then went back to graduate school, this time in turf management. So specifically in agronomy with a specialization in turf at Ohio State. And I got my master's there in 77 and my PhD in 79.
Wow.
So in terms of, you know, a lot of this is Chris, by the way, Nick, in the golf course industry, when you were a superintendent and doing that, what kind of close to our heart, being both Toro guys, what was the most interesting and challenging part of that job?
That's an easy one. when I was the superintendent in Southern Colorado, I put in an entire irrigation system, a Toro system, 1,300 irrigation heads, 72 controllers, 40 miles of wire. It was clearly the biggest project I've ever worked on. It took me about 7 or 8 months to complete that.
Wow. And you had help. You had help, I hope.
I had a crew. I had a day crew and a night crew. We still had a night watering crew. So I had a crew to manage the golf course and a crew to put in the irrigation system. And I think I was 23 years old, something like that. It was, let's just say it was stressful.
Well, you know, from reading the books that you had done and some of your published works, you know, what's interesting to me is, so you got that all put in and stuff. Putting it in was probably a challenge as well, making sure everything was placed correctly according to the plans. But how about the actual management of that? I mean, the training the people to know what to look for and understanding. I mean, the people that you hire, are they at the golf course under you, were they the same level of you, or they were just I don't want to use the word grunts?
I had some people with professional training, and they were the ones that I trained to handle the irrigation system. Most of them were just hourly laborers.
Okay.
But luckily I had some very good people that understood what was going on and could learn the ins and outs of a system like that.
Is it a lot easier today where you can walk around with your cell phone and see what's happening on the course?
I have an irrigation system here at the research station, and we have, the remote control and all that sort of thing. So it's better today. The control is better, but that was actually a pretty advanced system for its time back in the 70s.
Yeah, a lot of changes happening now. I mean, now golf courses as well as agriculture are now using satellite imagery, things like that. Locally, they're using drones, which can use a particular type of infrared cameras that can tell the health of the turf. So things have come a long way.
Oh yeah, the advancement in technology has really been striking through my career.
You know, with the drones, I don't know if you play golf yourself, Nick, but sometimes when I'm out there playing with guys, or even I'm just out there with having fun, I always wonder how come they always put the restroom facilities scattered way apart from each other. So the reason I'm asking this is because the drones fly over. Yeah. And I know a lot of guys that I've seen and play with, they don't wait to drive all the way back, six holes to go use the restroom. Yeah. They find a tree.
I'm just glad that you said when you go out to play golf, you have the intention of having fun. I go out with the intention of having fun. Then I start playing and it goes downhill from there.
Yeah. my handicap is golf.
We've had a lot of restrictions on drones out here, although it's opening up now. But that sort of thing hasn't been a problem, but it may in the future.
Yeah, I think it's it can bring a whole lot of new technology. I mean, some of the things they have now connect into different sensors, both on the drone and into the ground, and they feed back to the main central control system. And I think, obviously, they're very smart systems, and it's getting better every year. And
there's a long ways to go there, though. A lot we haven't mastered yet. We can take the data, but transferring that data into useful information is still an uphill battle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I mean, one of the benefits of drones is it gives you right on the spot immediately information that you can act on, right? There's companies out there that will go and do two flights a day over your course, and you can make adjustments. But you're absolutely right. The data that they provide is one thing, making it into usable information that you can use to create a benefit. That's the tough part.
Right.
Yeah, I did quite a bit of research with Toro back a number of years ago on remote sensing. We weren't using drones at the time, but infrared technology and that sort of thing. And making inroads into that is really hard to do when it comes down to it.
Right.
Yeah.
We're good at gathering data. We're not good at interpreting that data yet, and then making decisions on it.
Yeah. Well, Nick, you know, right at the beginning, Rob said, hey, you spend 54% of your time teaching and 46% in research. That's a fairly accurate number there. So what have been your main research focus then just on the 46% of your time?
It's changed quite a bit over time. Originally, I did a lot of work in fertility. I did a lot of work in growth regulators, herbicides. In more recent years, I've been doing quite a bit with alternative natural materials as pesticides, looking for things that are non-pesticidal that can still give us control of certain pests. And then more recently, biostimulants, looking at, you know, what works and what doesn't work.
Are you seeing any new standards being derived from genetic modified turf creations?
There's a lot going on with genetic modified turf. It's been slow reaching the market. You know, there's been a lot of restrictions. We had things like Roundup Ready Bent back in the 90s,
mm-hmm.
and that never that hasn't made it to market yet. There's a lot of new work going on in that area. There's work where through genetic modification they can put a growth regulator in the plant so it can control its growth, slow its growth. And that's really where the next level of technology is going to come from is molecular biology.
Who picks the type of turf and for the golf courses or for any of the big projects?
Well, yeah. Who picks that? It is so dependent on location, climate, the conditions on that particular course. The architect, of course, would have a lot to say about that. I've been involved in that sort of thing sometimes in the design of courses that are going in. That's an important question, and sometimes mistakes are made. You'll see them putting grass in environments where it probably shouldn't go. And then they find out the hard way over a few years that they've got to make a change.
Does it matter how long the roots are for the turf?
Oh, definitely. Rooting is critical for everything. Water use rate, survival of stress, efficient use of nutrients. The root system is absolutely vital.
Is there a minimum depth of the roots that have to...
Well, that depends on species. Now, the warm season species, like Bermuda, Zoysia, and species like this, have a much deeper root system. It's just part of their... They have a different photosynthetic system. They are much more tolerant of stress, and they'll have a root system that's usually down about 3 feet deep.
Okay.
Quite extensive. Now, the cool season grasses... The ones that we use in the north, like Kentucky bluegrass and the fescues and the ryes, they have a much shorter root system. They're at a different photosynthetic system. Most of their roots are going to be in the upper 12 inches.
Go ahead, Chris.
I was just going to say, you know, you hear about homeowners that buy a house and they really do no maintenance on their lawns, but here in the southwest part of the country, right, where it's hot and dry all the time, people think you just have to put water on it, right? But there's really a lot more you should do to keep your turf healthy. And this is probably more from a homeowner perspective than it is on the commercial side. And then a couple of things that I've read, and you see, well, you know, soil actually dies right after a certain period of time. So, you know, how does a homeowner quantify that? Like, so, or as the question that I'm seeing here written, when does soil die?
Well, soil really doesn't die. Soil, there's a living portion of the soil, and there's many, many different beneficial organisms that are active there. The only dead soil would be one where you've heated it in an autoclave or something and killed all the organisms, but they would return pretty quickly. Soil, the living portion of the soil is usually quite active, but it can get out of balance very easily. It takes proper management to maintain a healthy soil.
Well, what happens when you go to the store, you know, they sell bags of soil, all different types, And they package them in plastic. There's no mechanism for the soil to breathe. Like a big box store, they store them on pallets outside in the heat, in the sun. What happens, can that soil go bad by just being packaged and not having air or not having water to it? Or
I don't think so. I've never seen that happen or been aware of that. And, of course, that soil will vary in quality, but usually that's a pretty good topsoil that you get there. And the microorganisms in the soil will revive very quickly once you get that out in a flower bed or something like this where you've got sufficient moisture and oxygen. It'll recover very quickly.
Yeah, you know, I've thought about that, Nick, because, you know, I've bought bags of soil amendment and things like that, and I'm working out in the yard, and I'll leave those bags out in the sun, and they get ridiculously hot.
You could kill some microorganisms by doing that, but you'd be amazed how quickly those organisms bounce back.
Right. Microbes, yeah.
I had a chance to go out to one of the companies. It's called Kellogg's. Garden products, and they have a 52-acre facility near our facility. And I went out there with their chairman and Kathy Kellogg Johnson, and I was surprised when they were packing. They showed me how they prepare it and everything and clean it and do all their stuff, and then they were packaging it. And one of the people who was on the tour with me asked the question. He says, "Well, are all these have the when you're packaging that same type of soil? Is it all the same weight? How come you don't put the weight on it?" And she said, "Well, they pack it by cubic feet. They don't package it by weight." And so a couple of bags I bought last weekend, one was extremely heavier than another one of the same brand and type. And I was kind of, I guess, I don't know why
that. Yeah, water has a lot of weight.
Yeah.
So I can see where they couldn't do that on a weight basis.
Yeah.
So the moisture level would have a very big impact on that. So selling it on the cubic foot or the cubic yard basis would make more sense.
Now, you talked about things with pesticides and herbicides and fertilizer. Can you explain the differences for our listening audience between what we call consumer grade versus, I'm sure there's a professional grade level of those things?
There are professional grade. Now, often, those active ingredients are the same. They'll be packaged in different formulations. They'll be often more concentrated, and the professional user can save quite a bit of money by buying these materials and knowing how to mix them, knowing how to tank mix and spray. But it's generally the same active ingredients. And for the homeowner, they'll be packaged in a different way to make them more foolproof and safer. Mm. Scotts has always done a good job on that. They'll have nitrogen materials that have lower burn potential and things like this, and it's a little more foolproof for the homeowner. The professional usually has a much better handle on how to use that those types of materials, so they can use something that the homeowner won't. Now, there are a few active ingredients that are professional use only. If there's some safety concern or something like that, those will be restricted by the states to professional use only. But on average, most of the materials available to the professional are available to the homeowners, but in a less concentrated form.
Hey, Nick, if you don't mind, can I ask you a little question? Go back to the 54% of your time spent on teaching, and kind of ask you to look at a retrospective back through the many years that you've been teaching Colorado State and Ohio State.
And not to mention that we couldn't even start reading all the awards that you've got over your years. We're unbelievable. We're very honored that you're on our show.
Well, I've been at it a long time. This is my 39th year.
Right.
In fact, I'm just finishing my 39th year
this
week, and I'll go into my 40th year here at Iowa State.
That's so awesome. That's
I've
awesome.
I've had a long career. It's changed quite a bit in the teaching area. It runs in cycles. You'll have up times where you've got a lot of students. You'll have down times. They usually run at about 10-year cycles. Through the late 90s and early 2000s, we had a big bunch of students that came into the field. This was all over the country. I had 140 undergraduates specifically in turf at that time. Now we're since the recession, the interest has gone down in that, but the amazing thing is that the job market is up. We've got far greater demand than we've got students right now. So I think we'll see another cycle where the interest among students will increase again.
Well, it just seems, Nick, that by your description there, that they're kind of polar objectives, right? It's up when it should be down and down when it should be up. So
that's the way everything
is. these days it is, yeah.
Everything, you know, and prices and all this kind of stuff has the same kind of cycle. They kind of chase each other.
Well, Christian,
it's always a lag time.
Well, Chris and I were talking the other day, one of the most popular jobs today is being a lawyer in water business. That just seems to be there cropping up all over, and that's sort of a big deal now.
Yeah, environmental law is a big issue, right, these days.
Oh, and, yeah.
You know, it's a ton of them.
Yeah, that's a big deal here, too.
Yeah, I bet it is. So have you seen, you know, sort of like the interest level in agronomy or in turf sciences, soil sciences, things like that? Have you seen any major shifts across the many years you've been doing this, or has it been
yeah,
fairly?
Yeah, those shifts, like I say, run in about a 10-year cycle. It'll be up. Now I'm talking about student interest. So there'll be students all over the place. Everybody's interested in it, and then you get a lot of students. And in the last few years, it's been the recession that's had a really big impact on us.
Yeah.
That particularly in the golf industry, we had in the 90s we were opening a golf course a day, and we reached a point in the 2000s we were closing a golf course a day. So that had a big impact on the market for students and the interest level.
I know they're booming overseas.
It's coming back. And I think we'll see the students coming back.
Yeah, we're seeing a lot of things happening internationally on the golf side. All right, but what about your influence or your interest in agronomy on the agricultural side? Right, I mean in the food growing industry. What?
Well, my job is in the horticultural industry, but I own farmland here in Iowa with my brother and sister, so I am actively involved in that. My brother actually manages the farm, but I keep a pretty good handle on the agricultural side of it too, although my research is primarily in the turf and ornamental area.
So do you believe, this is a wild question, do you believe there's a need for artificial turf, or is it a current fad?
Is there a need? That's another thing that runs in cycles.
Right? Yeah.
we saw so many, even high school, going to a very expensive artificial field. Once they get them in, they're not quite as excited about that. There's the injury problem and things like that. And I think we're going through cycles on that, where we had a real up cycle on interest in artificial turf, and now we're seeing more interest in natural turf again.
I had read that there's some soccer fields back east that they've been doing studies with, and saying that children are subject now to with the mold and mildew stuff built up in the artificial turf, of getting cancer. And another interesting fact that I found out, you know who one of the largest manufacturers of artificial turf is? Monsanto, the ones who make carpets.
Oh, yeah.
They're like one of the large, or are the largest in the United States.
Yeah, there's health concerns. How much of that is real and how much of that is not real is kind of hard to sort out. But that gets to the parental level, and then they start complaining to the school district, and then there's an interest in putting natural turf back in. So.
Yeah.
I think we're going back into a cycle of much more interest in natural turf areas.
Yeah, I think perhaps, you know, there are some people that got a little disillusioned with it. You know, they thought it was the, you know, soup of the day, soup du jour sort of thing. And so we'll try it. And then, you know, a little bit less illustrious, you know, once they made the commitment and they got it put in. I mean, not to mention other facts like, you know, like heat islands that are created by that, and the fact that there's, you know, no return of oxygen into the atmosphere.
Yeah. It looks good. Okay.
Yeah, it looks good.
You don't have to mow, you know, maintenance-free,
right.
Not maintenance-free.
Yeah, it still needs to be cleaned.
There's a lot of effort. I've got several students that are managing artificial fields in the sports turf area, and there's a lot of management and work and and effort that goes into those as well. So well, you it's not like one is maintenance free and the other takes a lot of maintenance.
You still have to clean them. I know we make gigantic rotors.
In fact,
Chris is the product manager for that. And we had bought a company a little while ago that that does it. And they, how far is those things throw, Chris?
Yeah. Well, you know, up to 170 feet, right, or 220 feet, the largest one at the highest pressure. You know, but they're designed.
Got to cool those
designed for
out.
Cooling, cleaning, washing.
And they'll water artificial turf areas to keep them softer for the game. So it doesn't mean like you don't put any water on
them. Yep. Mm-hmm. Well, Nick, you know, I've heard you mention and Rob mention a couple of times the Scotts company, and I know that you've partnered with the Scotts company to create a sort of a do-it-yourself, a DIY book about irrigation and turf. All right, so can you tell us a little bit?
Well, actually, I'm the author of the Scott Lawn Guide to Your Beautiful Yard book. That's the primary one, and they've used some of that in some of their other publications. And there's definitely a section on irrigation in there, but that book is primarily the do-it-yourself guide for the homeowner. You know, what's the difference in grasses, what's fertilizer, how are pesticides used, and then irrigation is a part of that.
They should sell that at every big box store, because when I walk in and get something on a weekend, because I'm not going to drive back to my office to pick up a part or something, I'll go to the store and I listen to the conversations from the guys who work there telling the poor homeowners about stuff, and they really don't know.
Nick, maybe
I have some questions too sometimes, and I'm just shaking my head.
Maybe your book should be mandatory reading
it'll be sitting there on the shelf.
That's right.
There should be a reissue of that.
Yeah. Hey, but it's a fairly long book. It takes quite a commitment for a homeowner to buy that and look at it. And a lot of them do. I get a lot of phone calls from that where they've read something in the book and they'll call me or email me with a question.
Well, that's how I found out about you, so I did read it.
Oh, okay.
So
yeah, I don't know that. I checked one time a few years ago. Now, the first edition of that I worked on just after I finished my textbook in the 90s, so it probably came out about 99 or 2000.
Yeah.
And I checked once a few years after it had been out, and there's 400,000 copies that have been sold.
Well, I bought one, so I'm very happy for that.
And it'd be a lot more by this.
I actually bought it for my wife. But anyway, last question here, and we do appreciate your time. What would you consider to be the most significant discovery that could happen for the turf industry in the future?
Yeah, sort of forward-looking.
Yeah.
Yeah, forward-looking, definitely it's going to be in the molecular biology area. What they're capable of doing is absolutely amazing. Like I mentioned, they're working with genetically modified grass now where they can put a gene in it that affects the growth of the grass. And rather than spraying a growth-regulating chemical on it, it's produced internally.
In the plant.
Roundup Ready and that sort of thing. The real advancement the next few years is going to be in the molecular biology area.
Wow. Well, I'm excited to be in this business and learn a lot every day talking to people like you. And anyway, we do appreciate you coming on. And anybody should go look him up, Nick Christians. He's a prolific PhD who knows everything about turf that you can ever think of. And I learned a lot from reading his books and some of his publications that he's done. So, Nick, thank you very much for joining us today. We do appreciate it.
Yep, thank you. I was glad to be with you.
Great. Okay, everybody, we'll see you next week, and we have some good things happening. And remember, the most important thing you all should do this week is to
think blue.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
KCAA Loma Linda, 1050 AM, 106.5 FM, and now 102.3 FM.
NBC News Radio, I'm Brian Shook. President Trump is sticking with the current North Korean sanctions even as the summit with Kim Jong-un approaches. At the White House today, President Trump said